podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Buzz Podcast. I'm Trev Denny. I'm joined by Dave Hendrick for another episode. And we are this week going to look at the career of Cillian Murphy. In particular, we'll probably focus on the collaborations with Christopher Nolan. And this, of course, is in the wake of Cillian winning the big old acting gong during the week, as well as his director, Pal, as well as the movie itself, Oppenheimer. And it just felt like an appropriate time to do it. And of course, disproving the idea that it is not a small world and Irish people don't all know each other, we will have some interesting tales of what a small world Ireland can be to get started. But before we get any further, let me introduce Dave with a thanks to him for stepping into the breach last week when I was migrained out of it. I'd love to tell you I'm better. That would be a complete lie. But we are trying to get things back on track here and do two for you this week. So, Dave, we decided to do some bits and bobs on Cillian Murphy. Thanks for last week. Really appreciate it. Enjoyed that one when I was recuperating. How are you doing, more to the point? And what do you think about this particular choice? Do you reckon we've got at least an hour in this one?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we could do an hour on the fact that he's a Liverpool fan who once told Gary Neville he wouldn't take a picture with him, which even post Oscar win might still be his greatest achievement. Cillian Murphy's just a phenomenal actor, and he's had such an interesting career where he wasn't ever sort of the obvious leading man. And you did wonder at one point, is he going to become one of those great kind of secondary character actors who doesn't ever lead a big film, but kind of maybe goes and wins two or three best supporting actors and becomes the kind of guy that when you're casting your lead character and you're thinking about the rest of the cast, you're finding a role for Cillian Murphy because you know he's going to excel in a secondary role. But obviously, in the last 7 or 8 years, he's really stepped to the forefront and maybe even moved himself out of his own comfort zone, because we know he doesn't really like the glitz and the glam and the fame side of it, but he's taken off to an exceptional level.
Yeah, the thing about the most striking thing about Cillian too is he's a very, very unique looking individual, almost a pretty man, if you know what I mean, the cheekbones and the eyes and the lips and all the rest of it. And then you hear him talk and he's got a great voice, quite a sonorous voice. Mm. And he does have, I think, that thing that as he's aging, he's probably more traditionally handsome now than when he was younger, where, when you're younger, all those features in your face are more exaggerated and he really had to live in that very pretty man face for a long time. Whereas, I suppose maybe with the evolution of the Tommy Shelby character and in those years and since all the way up to Oppenheimer, he has this more sort of, maybe established kind of traditionally handsome face. And that is very much his stock and trade, not to denigrate him as an actor at all. That's not the point I'm making, but it's to echo what you were saying. There were only certain roles because in all those years, he didn't look like one of his big pals there, Tom Hardy, for example. Mm. He's a different, so people were inclined to give him, bad guy roles and supporting roles and stuff like that. But I think he's right slap bang in the middle of a wonderful era now. I think he's going to go on from strength to strength and really find himself the center of things. I saw somebody say recently on Twitter, because he was after the Oscar, he was being reported as a very, very strong contender for the next Bond, apparently, right?
Yeah.
And because he's still quite youthful looking and stuff like that, I suppose he could get away with doing a few. Daniel Craig looked a lot more old in the face than him, even when he started as a young man. And somebody said on Twitter, well, an Irish man will never play Bond. And I was like, did you miss the Pierce Brosnan from Navin era? Like, seriously. That's an odd one. But what do you think about that, about in terms of like, it does feel, doesn't it, as if he's kind of growing into his leading man status in terms of even just that simple thing of now he looks more the part. You can see why people are immediately saying, oh, he'd be a great Bond.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, you're right. When he was younger, he was very striking looking because he had like the cheekbones and those eyes, which obviously still to this day will just capture your view. If you look at a picture and he's in it, his eyes are so striking that they'll draw you in. But he's, you know, as you get older, you become a bit more weathered looking. And like you said, he's done the Tommy Shelby thing. And it's, you know, he's obviously crafted his image for that role for a long time as well. And I think he's really found himself as well. Like he seems to have found his own, he's always had his own kind of unique way of doing things, but even the way he dresses now is quite unique to him. Like he's not one that's all about designer nonsense and that. He just seems to wear what he feels suits him, and he's kind of gotten a more unique look now. But I mean, I'd love to see him as Bond because he's, you know, because you as I said before, we don't produce many. The ones we do produce will support them to the ends of the earth.
Yeah.
And it is just funny to me to have an Irish guy playing, you know, the quintessential British action hero, which is what I always found the Pierce Brosnan thing, both enjoyable because he was a good Bond, but also hilarious because obviously, you know, he's an Irish lad. And there's funny things with Killian where, like, he'll do random things and people will try and, you know, make more out of it. And maybe there is more to it. Like, I remember there's a video of him meeting Prince Harry. And he's standing there and he's got his hands in his pocket and Harry's walking along shaking hands. So he gets, just before he gets to Killian, Killian takes his hands out of his pockets. Then he shakes Harry's hand and then he puts his hands straight back in his pockets. And people were saying that a couple of centuries ago, there was this thing where the English landlords and such that ruled Ireland at the time would beat Irish people if they had their hands in their pockets, because they saw it as a sign of being lazy. You're not doing anything. Your hands should be busy.
Yeah.
And it was like, look at Killian Murphy taking one for his ancestors, putting his hands in his pockets. But he probably just did it because what else are you going to do with your hands? Do you know?
I get the distinct impression that within the certain confines of whatever he's contractually obliged to do, he would have a very similar attitude to you and I. I mean, I'm kind of openly, famously anti-lizard. It's been an issue for me in our other gig here with the Anfield Index shows that if I was to be on a show with Kenny Dalglish, I wouldn't be able to call him Sir Kenny because I don't believe in any of that bollocks at all. Like, it's very powerfully held belief with me. I don't want any of those lizard trinkets and I'm not going to acknowledge them. I remember having a conversation with my brother when we were considering doing all this film stuff back in the day and had high hopes and all, you know, what if we get on the late show and the next thing they're offering us a night out or something like that. And I remember saying that as a young lad, 19, 20, I'm not taking that.
No. You know?
And that's, it's a very strong, and Killian will go out of his way in every interview to mention that he's a proud Irishman.
Yeah.
He does. He just, it's a really noticeable thing. And he has gotten spiky with interviewers who haven't a clue and who think he's British. And he will point out again and again and again, if it needs doing, no, Irish, very different. You know, he's a good lad. I think he doesn't suffer fools. I've seen several patented Killian eye rolls as well. I'd say he's a lad now who has very strong ideas. And on the back of doing The Wind That Shakes the Barley, he said that even though he had an idea of that period of history, he did his research and he came out of it, I'd say, like an awful lot of us do, a lot more patriotic, with a lot more stronger views. I mean, I remember coming out of the cinema on O'Connell Street, having watched Daniel Day-Lewis play Jerry Conlon. I said this in a previous pod, and man, I just wanted to get on a boat and go over there and sort the Brits right out.
So I'm absolutely the same. But The Wind That Shakes the Barley, I remember vividly the day I saw it. So I was standing you know the bus stop shop in Navan?
Yes.
I'm standing there and I'm chatting to a friend of mine, and a couple of other lads that were we'd have been close with come wandering over, and we were like, what are you doing? And they were like, we're going to see The Wind That Shakes the Barley, because it had come in like the day before or something. And I was like, oh, fuck, I'd love to go and see that. I'll go with you. Because it was getting a lot of hype, like. And yeah. I didn't really know the full story of what it was about, because just, you know, at that 2006, you didn't have as instant access to everything as you do now. So we went and we saw it. And when we came out, we were nearly looking for the nearest RA sign-up sheet to go and join the revolution. Like, that powerful of a feeling coming out of it.
Yeah, it's
and that to this day remains one of my favorite films that he's done. It's one of my favorite films. I think it's a phenomenally good story, phenomenally well done. But he in that film, like, I'd obviously seen him in a bunch of different things before, but it was in that film playing Damien O'Donovan that I looked at him and I thought, you're really special at this.
Yeah, the gravitas in that performance, the way he can hold the camera, like I even in early stuff, like I remember because again I was big into it. I remember seeing Disco Pigs early on and thinking, wow, that's very very impressive. Some people might think it was a little bit over the top, but the guy's suffering a lot of mania. But it's more just he holds the camera. And this is one of these, again, with our football podcast, you'll often find yourself talking about intangibles where you're trying to describe a player who has an extra moment on the ball. And it's not because he can manipulate space and time, but in a way he can. And it's an intangible thing. And with actors, some people have that where they can suffer the camera on them for a great length of time and carry a scene. And some are more functional and perfunctory and can do a job, but they start to wilt if the camera's on them for too long and if they have to be overly dramatic for too long. And that's in and of itself a real, I think, sort of feather in the cap of him as a performer. You know, it's a special thing, like you say.
Yeah, 100%. It's like that thing where you just feel like you said, within football, it's almost like the game slows down for that player and everybody else is moving at 1,000 miles an hour, but they can slow everything down and like you said, manipulate time and space. And it's the same with these kind of great actors. And we've obviously talked at length about Daniel Day-Lewis in the past, and he's one that I've always felt has been brilliant at that, where he has a scene and it might only be 20 seconds, but it's the most impactful 20 seconds in a 15-minute span. And I think Cillian Murphy's exactly the same, where you're almost, if he's not in the scene, you're waiting for his next scene because you know he's going to deliver something really good.
Yeah.
And he does fit into that caliber of actor where you watch them work and you think, God, it must be inspiring for the others around him, the others in that film, who all in their own right are very, very good,
yeah,
but they're watching a genuine master. And Peaky Blinders has become obviously a phenomenon. But when you watch that show, and there's great actors everywhere, but the scenes with Cillian Murphy as Tommy Shelby, they're on a different level. There's just something where you're watching it and you don't think that's Cillian Murphy playing Tommy Shelby. You just think that's Tommy Shelby.
Yeah.
And fuck it, I want to be Tommy Shelby. I'm getting that haircut. I'm buying them clothes. Where do I find one of them hats? That's who I want to be when I grow up, even though I am fully grown up now.
I think that's actually really, really a good point on that particular TV character, that show. I went on a wander around Liverpool last time I was over, and if you go down the docks a little way, you'll come across a massive, big Peaky Blinders themed pub that's now closed, but it was hugely popular. And you just sort of, in Liverpool, right? And you just sort of understand, oh God, that thing was fucking massive. Like, you know, culturally massive on a scale that they couldn't possibly have foreseen. And he's absolutely the linchpin. I mentioned Tom Hardy earlier on. I think he's the second best character in that show.
I love him. I love that show.
And the best parts, it's like a little treat when you get Tommy and Alfie together. Yeah. Like
very first scene they do together.
Yeah.
When Tommy goes to meet him, and you can just tell there's this instant chemistry between them.
Yeah.
So like you said, like every time the two of them come face to face, you're rubbing your hands together because you're like, this is going to be brilliant.
Yeah. You just know it's going to be brilliant. And like the Alfie character's delightfully unhinged. Tommy's like the sort of, he's got like a minimal emotional output with everything except anger. So but he seems to be a different fella around Alfie. And I think that's because he's probably a slightly different fella around Hardy. If you see them interviewed together, they're genuinely buds, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that really, obviously we'll get to the Christopher Nolan stuff, but it's probably built on the back of all those collabs with him. But yeah, loads for us to get our teeth into here. Sorry, excuse me. I'd like to tell you, like I said, all is well health-wise, but it is clearly not. So do forgive me if there's a little bit of coughing or sore throat or rumbly sound and voice. Apologies in advance for that. Let's, if you don't mind, take a look down through the early days, and we'll do it via the font of knowledge until it's not. That is Wikipedia, which I'm sure you have open. And if you go to the filmography, this is where the small world stuff is going to start coming in. So his first film role that we can see there is, well, actually, if you skip on down, really, the first theater thing he does is 96 to 98, where he plays that character, Darren, alongside Elaine Cassidy's character in Disco Pigs. And that was quite a huge thing. Enda Walsh made the movie and wrote the story, and it was a huge cultural phenomenon. And it was his first leading role. And he reprised it then in the film, which came out in 2001. But before that was when I was aware of Cillian Murphy for the first time, because a pal of mine worked on Ballygus Angel, which you've recently done a massive section on there in the last show.
Love it.
And you know, the one thing that comes across about Ballygus Angel when you're talking about it is it's very charming, right? A very charming show. So my pal was working as a first AD on Bally K for years, and doing some film work as well, whenever anything will come up. And in some of the things that came up, he found himself working with Cillian Murphy. And as a result of him meeting and getting to know Cillian, he was able to tell me that they would hang out set because he's just a sound fucker, right? That was the general thing. Now, he's a couple of years younger than me, I think maybe 2 years younger than me. My pal Dermot is the same age as me, so we'd have been a couple of years younger than him as well. But he was very, very unassuming and sort of just a sound lad. I heard some fantastic stories from the set of Bally K. I'm going to leave you with this little one before we move away from it, just to fill out a little bit of info for you. There was someone on the set of Ballygus Angel who was possibly not the nicest, and who during a scene, in the build up to one scene, was chewing some gum and then had to go straight into the scene, took it out of her mouth and placed it straight in the paw of my pal. Take that for me, will you? Now, I just thought I'd drop that one in there so you and your missus can be working out who's this, and I'll tell you next week. So that's just a little by-the-by inside baseball. But just to set this up, so he starts off, there is Disco Pigs the film, but in 96 he's doing the play. He has his first little role in a movie called Quando. Then he's in The Tale of Sweetie Barrett, which was quite a big noise on the Irish film scene at the time. There was a lot of movies getting made in Ireland back then, and there was a kind of coterie of characters that were always in there. You know, the same faces all the time were in there. Like, for example, when we come to Intermission, they're all in there, right? He then does Eviction, which is a short film, Sunburn, At Death's Door and The Trench, which is the first one that I was aware of. In 2000, he made a short film as part of an Irish language thing, which I have the DVD of because I used them in my work to show lads short films. Brendan Gleeson's in one of them. He's the star of one. And the Bell Killian is in one called Fillin an Fial. Alongside, and here's another crossover with Ballykay, Frankie McCafferty. And here's another crossover. In that year, I also made a film with Frankie. So it's just the smallest of worlds, Dave.
It is. This is a very, very small country. And you forget how small a country it can be and how there will always be connections. So as you're saying, you became aware of Killian very early. I remember you'd know Richie Ball, who was an English teacher in St. Pat's for decades. Might still be there. You never know, Richie. I assume he's retired by now. But Richie was hugely into drama and hugely into the theatre and was always very much had his finger on the pulse of what was going on in the Irish art scene. And I remember just randomly having a conversation with him one day. He was, I never actually had Richie as a teacher, but he was filling in some one day. I think our class would have been a little bit raucous at times, and I think he was sent in to keep manners on us when we had no teacher or whatever for a period. And we're chatting away as a group, and, you know, some people can't be arsed, but he was always very interesting to listen to, and he'd get very passionate about certain things. And he had seen Killian in, I assume it was Disco Pigs, in the theatre.
Yeah.
And people were asking him, like, who are the big actors to keep an eye on? Who are the big Irish actors to keep an eye on over the next few years? And the two he named were Killian Murphy and Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. And he said he would be stunned if they don't both become significantly well-known. And obviously now we know what Killian has done. And Jonathan Rhys-Meyers has had a tremendous career of his own. Maybe hasn't reached the heights that people thought he might when he was doing The Tudors. I think people thought this is going to be the real springboard for him and he's going to go to different levels now. But he's had a great career. He's made some fantastic stuff. But I've always remembered Richie Ball naming those two as the two to keep an eye on. So it always stuck in the back of my head whenever I saw Killian Murphy's name that I'd go and watch whatever he was in, because I'd been told years before this guy is going to be something. And he would have only been, he'd have been in his early 20s at the time, Killian would. I think he was, was he born in like, was he born 76 or something?
76, yeah.
Yeah, so he'd have been about 21, 22 when Richie named him. And obviously now, like if he'd put money on it himself, he'd be a very wealthy man now.
I think Rhys-Meyers is a fellow Corkonian, and I'd be hearing, because again, I was sort of had my snout in it, be hearing little things. And again, the reputation that Killian had was for being very sound, whereas I think Jonathan Rhys-Meyers was a bit more standoffish as a young fella. But that was a mad period, because you had the famous German-Irish lad coming through from Kerry around the same time as well there, Fassbender, and obviously Colly Farrell in Dublin. And that's quite the foursome to be firing out of a country at one time.
It is on various levels. If you look at Irish Academy Award winners, just since 2015, you've got Michael Fassbender, you've got Killian Murphy, and you've got Paul Mescal, who was nominated for Best Actor last year, along with Colin Farrell. Obviously, neither of them won it. And you've got Killian. And then even, like, you've got Kieran Hines, Brendan Gleeson, Fassbender again, Barry Keoghan. You've had a lot of nominations for Best Supporting Actor. We've had four for Best Actress, a couple for Best Supporting Actress. Like, some of them are much younger, some of them are a few years older, but there has been this great run of these tremendous Irish actors coming along. Sort of Kerry Condon would be a few years younger than Farrell and and Reese Myers and Killian Murphy about 5-6 years younger. But again, would have been similar enough generation. Obviously, she was up for Best Supporting Actress last year. And it is just, it's interesting to see just how many really impressive actors came from that era and also from that part of the world, because you mentioned Fassbender, it was in Kerry, The Two Boys in Cork, Kerry Condon is from Tipperary. Must be something in the water in Munster, because that's four outstanding actors to come along within a 5-6 year gap of each other.
And there was a lot of movies getting made at the time. Mm. You know, there was a real buzz around the Irish film industry. It did. The arse fell out of it when the arse fell out of everything else. Maybe a little bit before, to be honest. But it did drop off spectacularly. Before that period of time, there was a lot happening. You know, I'd be wandering out in town with the aforementioned Dermot there, and we might go down to Lily's, and you know, you could be sitting beside, as I was 2 weeks in a row in Lily's Bordello, sitting beside Neil Jordan or sitting beside Bono.
Like, or sitting beside Eamon Dunphy.
Eamon Dunphy would always be there to this. But like, it was the best part about Small World Dublin is nobody gives a shit. Nobody will bother you. I was having a chat with Neil Jordan as if I didn't know who he was. I had a couple of words over and back with Bono, who's, you know, in his own way, a terrible set of lads. But I didn't understand that back at the time. So I was kind of, this is cool.
Yeah. Is he Bono?
Yeah.
Like, it's still be cool. He's a terrible set of lads. He's still Bono, though.
That's the thing.
But that is the thing I love about Dublin. Like, I remember I worked in Dublin for years and years. And, like, I worked up around Merrion Square. And you could randomly walk out the front door of the office, and the Merrion Hotel was across the road, and you'd see all manner of celebs coming out. I physically bumped into Sarah Jessica Parker one day, and had a very brief conversation with her and Matthew Broderick, and they were lovely and couldn't believe that they could just walk around Dublin and no one was bothering them.
Yeah, you know.
that was the thing about Dublin back then, is you'd be walking up the street and, you know, you'd look around and there'd be a famous actor walking towards you, just going about their business.
Yeah,
I saw Brendan Gleeson more times than I could count, just out doing normal day-to-day stuff. And it's that funny moment where you think, oh, he shops there, I shop there as well, me and him. We're the same.
But that we're the same thing, I got to such extremes in the late 90s around Dublin that I had built in this sort of physical response that if I saw someone famous, I'd nearly look away. I was just like, I'm too cool to be showing any interest in fucking celebrities. I admit that. But part of it was, I'm not going to bother this person at all. Like, it was an absolute... I wrestled with my conscience one day at the bottom of Grafton Street as I saw the lads from Primal Scream, Bobby and Manny, who used to be in the Stone Roses. And the Stone Roses were an impossibly important band to me when I was growing up, like formative, like the first band I loved. And I just wanted to say to Manny, mate, thanks for all like those songs. And like... it would have been just in passing. I eventually said, oh, fuck it, I'll just go and do it. So I did. I said hello to him. And I couldn't get rid of him then, right? Because he was like, where's a good place for a pint? Are you going to come for a pint with us? We do this, we do that. What's the time? Where can I get a bus to this place? I'm like, Manny, you're getting a bus. Like, I couldn't. Yeah. I think they were so disarmed by the fact that people give them the space to breathe. It's a really good cultural thing we have here. At least we had.
Yeah,
still the case.
As an aside on Manny, there's a funny story about him. Like, you think the success that guy had with the Stone Roses and Primal Scream, and yet there's a story about when United got to the Champions League final in '99, he had to sell his scooter to afford his flights and tickets and hotel. So like, he was just a normal guy, and he got money, he spent money. He wasn't one for planning ahead at the time.
But he always
had that sort of, I'm just a working class lad from a working class area in Manchester. I'm not above anybody. Now, there's a certain person in his band that very much thinks he's above everybody else, but Manny and the others always just seemed really grounded. Like, and I think that's part of why so many of them love Dublin as opposed to, say, London, where there's probably, it's probably like more of a fishbowl. Even though there's 100 times more celebrities there, there's probably more intrusion there because of how the British press operate. Whereas
that's it.
Here, that's it. It's completely different. Like, I remember walking, you know where the Shelburne Hotel is? I was walking past it one day. And as I'm walking up, I can see Aidan Gillen coming towards me.
Mm.
I'm like, that's Aidan Gillen. And this fella comes out of the Shelburne down the steps and bumps into him. And doesn't apologize. Just kind of bulls through him and gets into a car and takes off. And as I'm walking by Aidan Gillen, he's muttering under his breath the same way we would about how he'd love to slap the head of that rich twat. Now, I can't think of the exact words he said because he couldn't quite make them, but you could tell he was living. But again, it's just he could very easily have big-timed the guy.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He just kind of kept going like, yeah, I'm just a normal guy. That's some rich twat. I'll just keep going about my business. But that's always been my favorite thing about Dublin, is to just walk around and just people spot, and not just celebrities, but normal people, and just watch people go about their lives and how comfortable everybody is in Dublin. Like, there's a real Dublin, I find, has a wonderful character to it.
Mm.
A lot of cities have their own character. You mentioned Liverpool earlier on. There's a wonderful character about Liverpool where, you know, if someone dropped you off in Liverpool and you didn't know where you were, within 20 seconds, without even hearing a voice, you know you're in Liverpool. I find Cork is the same. Galway is the same. But Dublin has this extra bit of charm for me, where there's a very Dublin way of doing things. And there's actually two Dublin ways of doing things, depending on which side of the river you're standing on.
That's a fact.
But it's just, where people, like, people don't always appreciate, there's a view of Irish people that's, you know, a little bit hokey from certain areas, that, you know, we're all, you know, Guinness drinking piss heads and whatever else. But there's something about being Irish, and I think it's what draws us to other Irish people and wants us and makes us want to see other Irish people do well, where there's just certain things that you understand about living here. And it's things you can get away with that you maybe would get looked at very strangely somewhere else. And I think the celebrity culture falls into that, where, like, you'll see a celebrity walking in the road, and if they're trying to big time, people will just outright call them out on it. There's no airs and graces in this country. I remember one night being stood at the side of Stephen's Green Shopping Centre, and there was a Ferrari doing laps of the green. And it's a Ferrari, so you stop and you watch, and you're like, he's just doing laps, so clearly he's looking for a bit of attention. And next thing, it went round with the hood down, with the top down. And it was Brian McFadden of Westlife fame, who was a couple of years out of Westlife at this point, and it's sort of become irrelevant. So I'm watching him, and he goes around once with the top down, and as he comes back around the second time, some fella just shouts, "Would you stop doing laps, you fat-headed fool? We know it's you." Why, as big as you might become, you'll always get pulled back down in this country. So you're always just better off to just be yourself and be normal.
There you go, the double-edged sword. Like, once people are sound, like, we're here relating to Aidan Gillen being pulled out, there's another one. Fucking hell, man, there's another one. And there's crossover, of course, with Piggy Blinders there as well, speaking of small worlds. Let's drive this on another bit, because in 2000, like I said, he made that short film with Frankie McCafferty, and I thought I was aware of that. And I was working with Frankie at the time, very funny fella, good lad, great lad to do a comic role, as you know, from the TV show you're watching.
Brilliant. He's such good value in it.
He just is. He just is. And the thing with Frankie as well, like, he's obviously painfully aware of it, is like, he's very a unique looking chap too. So yeah, that kind of adds to it. Then there's On the Edge, How Harry Became a Tree, and Disco Pigs, reprised as a movie in 2001. And then we're into it. 2002 is where it really kicks off in terms of Killian being a star, because Danny Boyle, after I think 5 auditions, gives him the role of Jim, the central character, where he plays alongside Brendan Gleeson, doing a passable English accent, I suppose. Again, crossover. In this post-apocalyptic zombie drama that came out of nowhere. And of course, Danny Boyle had very much put himself on the mark, on the map with Trainspotting, and then what was the other one with Ewan McGregor set in Edinburgh, the three central characters. Oh man, my brain has gone into mush. It'll come back to me anyway. But these were the two ones that really put Danny Boyle on the map. It was like, oh, this guy is a talent. And this was such a departure. Oh,
Shallow Grave.
Yeah, thanks. And this one is such a departure. And, you know, there's all these incredible scenes that they shot at 4 a.m. where they just basically waited for the light to come up and then said, can you not walk here for a while? And they got the art team to go and dress the street. I saw Killian doing an interview saying that there are loads of people with basically HD cameras everywhere, or DV cameras, I think it was the predecessor, just snapping away, shooting away to get all these cool empty street shots from as many different angles as possible. And it gives you that wonderful opening sequence to the film. It's very cool. It's very striking. And Killian looks pretty cool in it with the half shaved off head and all the rest of it. And it just, I think that's the one for me where I went, ah, yeah, this lad's going places.
Mm. Yeah, that's a fantastic film. And like you said, Danny Boyle was really on the up as well. So it was for Killian to kind of connect with Danny Boyle at that point in Danny's career where, like you said, he's done Shallow Grave, he's done Trainspotting, he did The Beach, had been the previous one with Leo DiCaprio. So he was very much on the ascendancy. So his next film after The Beach was going to get a lot of attention and a lot of publicity. And it's like such a departure. It's unbelievable that he went from doing The Beach to this. But it's I think it's an excellent film. And I actually watched it about 3 years ago. And it holds up so well.
Oh,
particularly
really
given what we've just lived through with COVID and that, like films like this become, so it's actually 4 years. I watched it the year COVID kind of broke. I watched all of the films about viruses and pandemics and destruction of global society. I watched them all in about a 3 week span because what else were we meant to do? We couldn't leave the house. And like that, it holds up so well to this day. And even now there's stuff like you said, like, That opening sequence, like if that happened now, you'd be like, wow, that's really fresh. Like there's a newness to that. And that was 22 years ago that Danny Boyle came up with that vision.
It's a unique piece, a one-off piece, really strong cast. None more so than Killian himself. But this is also the year where we're going to have to pause on the next film on the list here on the Wikipedia because it's Intermission. Now, excuse me, Intermission is one of those movies that I was talking about that was getting made, loads of big movies that were getting made in Ireland around about this time, from the mid to the 90s to the mid noughties. It's a who's who of the Irish film and TV scene. It's remarkable how that happens. You know, I was talking to you a little bit about my pal Dermot, who's an AD, and he got me a special extra, it was called, where you had a line. You were an extra, but you had a line on a movie called On the Nose. I bring that up because the director of On the Nose is David Caffrey, who's also the director of the movie we're going to talk about, and who's also the director of Peaky Blinders.
Hmm.
So this is quite interesting. And in that Caffrey movie that I got the little line in, it was a mad day. You know, there was Dan Aykroyd, Robbie Coltrane, Brenda Blethyn was in it. She wasn't in the scene with me. Jim Norton, who plays Bishop Brennan and Father Ted, was there. Don Baker, that kind of musician, harmonica musician lad. Glynis Barber was in the scene with me, and I was just like, I couldn't stop staring at her. She was so gorgeous. And Simon Delaney from several Irish productions was also in it. And this is what tended to happen. If there were people around, now that's a little bit international, getting Aykroyd and that in and Coltrane. But if there was a movie getting made, you could rely on the same faces showing up. And in intermission, they're nearly all there. And I know it's a real favorite of yours.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to explain this, isn't it? Like, it begins, and here's another brilliant coincidence. It begins with this really, really powerful scene where we see Colin Farrell playing a North Dublin scroat type lad who's laying all the charm to a girl who's working behind the counter. That girl just happens to be Kerry Condon.
Yeah.
Before he punches her right in the face. And it's just really shocking as an intro.
Yeah.
You're off to the races then.
Yeah. If ever an opening scene set the scene for what a film was going to be, it is that. It's the typical thing that you'd see in any Irish shop of some fella trying to flirt with the guy, with the girl behind the counter. And you'd see it up and down the country on a weekly basis. You walked into a shop, there'd always be some fella in there trying to crack on to one of the female staff. And then out of nowhere, he just absolutely obliterates her with a dig. You're like, Jesus Christ, can you really put that in a film? But I do. I love this film. And obviously Cillian and Colin Farrell are the two that really have exploded from this cast. But I've always had such a soft spot for Colin Meaney. I think he's an absolutely tremendous actor, and he's had a great career as well. But I would watch Colin Meaney read the newspaper if someone wanted to make a half hour short of it. I just think he's brilliant. And obviously he'd done a lot of different stuff, but it was really like he'd been sort of an extra in a bunch of things, but it was really The Commitments, where he plays Jimmy Rabbit Sr., that sort of brought him to global notice. Because The Commitments was one of the first Irish films that really took off in that way, where it wasn't necessarily expected to be this huge hit, but it was an enormous hit. And obviously it spanned a bunch of sequels as well. But I love Colin Meaney, and in this film I love his character in this film. I just think he properly leans in. Like, you know, when we're doing AI stuff and we're talking about refs and how they just look like they might be a copper.
Yeah.
And there's an idea you have in your head of what a copper is, and especially here in Ireland, where there's a lot of good ones, obviously, but there's a good portion of them that they got a badge, they got some power, and they watched too many films of other cops.
Yes.
And he is that exact guy. And he reminds me of a cop that used to work in Navan years ago, who's actually a lovely guy away from the uniform. But in the uniform, he's an absolute pillock. And it's he's just brilliant. And he'll listen to this as well. He'll know who I'm talking about. But he's so good in this. Absolutely so good.
The way that he has the director, the aspiring director dude wrapped around his finger, you know, like the guy that I think it's an actor called Tom Sullivan plays him.
Yes.
He's just in awe of of the presence that Colm's Jerry Lynch has, and he's doing this like a big feature of it. Him following Colm around as he actually genuinely does seem to have a big Hardshaw reputation, and throws his weight around with some effect. I mean, there's one scene where Colin Farrell squares up to him and he basically just corners him and then literally pisses on his shoes. And it's just like, okay, this is real Law of the Jungle stuff. But the best feature, and I'd love to know, and I'm going to go on ahead and assume that it was the writer who came up with this, but the thing that will never leave me about Intermission is the fact that Jerry's little quirk is that he's into Celtic mysticism.
Yeah.
The music of Clannad and various groups like that, which is very unique and basically all, like, you know, wrapped up in Irish mythology and sort of haunting, evocative vocals and traditional sounding mixed with modern music. And he keeps referring to them as, you know, do you know Celtic mysticism? You know, like Clannad, Fáinne Ollasta. He says, artists like that.
Artists.
And I'm like, it's perfect that he uses that word. It's perfect, you know, because he has notions about himself, you know, and he has notions about himself as, you know, the central character in his own little story. And it's interesting because, you know, Farrell's kind of marginalized. I think he probably only had a couple of days on set, but it was a huge deal to get him in it because he was really breaking big.
Yeah.
But Killian's John is sort of the core of the film, you know, like, his good friend David Wilmot, who plays Oscar in this. You couldn't make a film in Ireland with David Wilmot. You just couldn't. If you're wondering who David Wilmot is, he's the red-haired lad that's in every Irish film ever. Brian F. O'Byrne is in this one as well. And Michael McElhattan, who, again, you couldn't make an Irish film without him being in it at a certain point in time, is in it as well. And they're all sort of orbiting each other in various ways, but it's a very restrained kind of performance for the most part, isn't it, from Killian?
It is, yeah. Like, his involvement is because he's separated from the missus and can't really get over her, and he's kind of lost in life, which, you know, you can kind of relate to yourself. You know, if you're in a long-term relationship and it ends and your whole universe is sort of revolved around that one person, which can often be the case when you're younger and you think, like, this relationship is the one and it's everything, so I have to basically commit everything to it, and then that relationship goes away and you're left with this massive empty void. But he obviously gets himself caught up with Collie's character Lahiff, gets himself caught up with Brian F. O'Byrne's character, Mick, the bus driver, who's in a bad way at the time. And they bond over putting brown sauce in tea, which to this day is still one of the weirder things ever committed. And I would love to know what percentage of Irish males between the ages of 14 and, say, 30, at that time, the next time they had a cup of tea, went, "Where's the brown sauce? Did I try this?
Just try it."
Yeah, because I'd say Chef and HP were making fortunes off the brown sauce then for weeks and weeks after this film came out.
Because it's one of those things you would either go, "That's disgusting," or "I have to try this."
Yeah,
and there's a couple of things there that you mentioned. First of all, nobody at any stage makes any mention of Colin Farrell's character name, which is fucking mental.
Yeah. Like,
what even is that?
Yeah.
Like, when I watched the movie the first time, I didn't know what they were saying. I just thought they were making noises. I had to see it written down before I understood what they were saying. And the other thing then is, do you remember the scene in Intermission where the lads go because David Wilmot, who's Oscar, who's John's best buddy, Killian Murphy's best buddy, he's in a bad way for a little bit of sexual release. So they go to a place where they've been informed that there'll be a lot of older clientele that will definitely stick with them as the young lads. Now, I happen to have been living in Dublin at the time, and I don't think it's talking outside baseball or inside baseball even to say that that was definitely Howl at the Moon, which you'll be aware of.
Yeah.
Which was at the top of Merrion Square. And it was very much a well-known spot for the Cougars. Yes.
100%. Yeah. 100%. Like when I had been there.
So had I. That's the point.
Yeah. 100%. And that's what it was like. And it was, but it was absolutely a fantastic night out to go there. There's no question.
let's just say it worked.
Yeah. Without a shadow of a doubt.
2003, he's on a roll. Intermission, then Girl with a Pearl Earring. He's got a part in that. He's got a part in Cold Mountain, which is a big old film in terms of the production and cast and all the rest of it. Philip Seymour Hoffman's in it. Brendan Gleeson's in it. Renee Zellweger's in it. Nicole Kidman, Jude Law. It's a big old epic by Anthony Minghella. So it shows that he's mixing now in the right sort of circles, if you like. And then we get 2005. And in 2005, he begins his relationship in terms of professional interactions with Chris Nolan. And in Batman Begins, where he plays Jonathan Crane, the Scarecrow. And again, when you look back at those movies, it's amazing to see how youthful Killian looks in it. But he does have the gravitas to carry off this sort of serious character stroke, comic book villain character. You know, he can do big eyes, but he has that thing, and it's a much... I think underestimated aspect of him that comes to the fore really with Tommy Shelby as well. He has the voice.
Yeah.
Oh, he can do that thing where he can speak in that certain register.
But he'd send a shiver up your spine as well.
Yeah.
With some of the delivery and like the look as well, because you know he's quite haunting looking in that film. And I watched an interview recently where Christopher Nolan was saying he actually came in and read for Batman originally.
That's right.
Yeah. Nolan hadn't landed on Christian Bale, and it by the sounds of it, now he didn't outright say it, but by the sounds of it, it came down to a choice between a few. He landed on Bale, but Killian was very much a finalist for that role and was so impressive that he was like, I have to get him in somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. There was another part that he had in mind, and the Scarecrow, I don't know if people are into the comics, is like one of the oldest of the villains in the whole sort of Batman universe. And, you know, around about this time, before the Lycra stuff really took off and, you know, got, I thought, just a bit too difficult for me to stomach, at least. I had to bail out of the Marvel universe eventually. I know some people are still massively into it. I never got into any of these big Star Wars spin-offs or anything like that. But around about this time when they were starting those all early movies, like when there was an Iron Man movie and a Batman movie, these are comics that were special to me when I was a kid. Batman, actually later on, I got into the graphic novels, and I remember Arkham Asylum, still one of the most impactful things I've ever read. Like I class that as a book which had as big an impact on me as some classic novels. I just thought it was an absolutely incredible story. So these kind of movies were important, and these reboots of old franchises. And Nolan brings with the Batman played by Bale a certain new seriousness to it that you were getting from your comic book movies now. Like I think Downey Jr. when he gets Iron Man, that's what makes the Marvel Universe. That cast, yeah. that moment of casting, you know, he's just picked up his own Oscar alongside Killian a week ago there for the same movie. It's probably long overdue. He is an outrageous talent, his cousin Bob, but that's a side note. In that year as well, there's Red Eye, where he plays this kind of almost two-dimensional bad guy on a plane. And then there's Breakfast on Pluto, which is a really incredible role where he spends most of it sort of in makeup and wearing a wig and in all sorts of various female clothing, playing Patrick Kitten Braden. That's a book by an author who, if you have not read any Pat McCabe, can I heartily suggest you do read some Pat McCabe. You could start with Breakfast on Pluto, or you could start with Carn or The Butcher Boy, or you could start with any one of his books. I think I have all of them. I love Pat McCabe. He's one of these guys who, like Kevin Barry, I think they're my two favorite currently writing Irish authors. Man, they can spin a yarn and they can get into the head of these absolutely mental characters that they create. And that's a very brave choice by Cillian Murphy there, I think.
Massively, massively, because, you know, especially when we're talking about that era, 2005, it wasn't it just wasn't really the done thing at the time. It was a very much out there type of project. And I think he's absolutely phenomenal in that role. And it's one of his, like, if you were to list his best films, you wouldn't go far before you'd get his best performances, I should say. You wouldn't go far before you'd land on that, because he really does just absolutely own the screen in that film.
It's a fact. Now, we've left ourselves a bit top heavy here, but I think it's working out well because everybody knows what Cillian's done since then. They may not have known about the stuff that we were talking about up to now. Mm. And the hits just start coming then. We mentioned The Wind That Shakes the Barley. That's a huge movie made on Irish soil with all the usual suspects. Some great cast in that as well. That's 2006. Then in 2007, he reconnects with Danny Boyle in Sunshine, another really, really unusual movie, kind of high concept sci-fi thing that Danny Boyle directs. He plays Robert Capa, a scientist. And again, it's a very intense, powerful performance. There is The Dark Knight, where he reprises Jonathan Crane in 2008, a movie called The Edge of Love, which I'm not familiar with. Then he's back in the Irish waters again.
This film.
Perrier's Bounty, 2009.
Maybe
have a word about that one, because that'll be one of the ones that people might know as much of.
Yeah, so it's you know, this was a film I would imagine that got its funding before the arse fell out of the Irish economy.
Yeah.
Because it was one of only a few that got made in this era. This was 2009. And Cillian plays Michael McCrae, who's just, you know, a complete waster. And he just, you know, falls in line with a guy he owes money to, played by Brendan Gleeson, who plays the local crime boss. And again, with Brendan Gleeson, I'd watch anything that he's in. You've got Jim Broadbent, who plays Cillian's father.
He's brilliant.
And again, I just another incredible actor that I'd watch do anything he wants to do, because he's so good. I think he's become incredibly underrated as well as time has gone on. But like, I go back with him to Roy Slater in Only Fools, all the way through to him playing Horace Slughorn in the Harry Potter films, and everything in between and everything since. I just think he's incredible. But it's just this, you know, it's this idea of you owe me money, you're going to have to find a way to repay me. And there's, you know, hijinks and there's shenanigans. And it's a really good film that has some really touching moments between father and son.
Is it fair to say, Dave, that it's one of those movies in the tradition of Intermission, which has, yeah, there's action and there's some, like, you know, threat, danger, peril at the heart of it, a plot to follow, but that it's one of those movies like Intermission that does have a bit of a comedy core to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, to be honest, it's the relationship between Cillian Murphy's character and Jim Broadbent's character that really drives it, because there's like, they're kind of estranged at one point, and then Cillian learns that his dad is dying, and there's this, you know, this want to reconnect, but there's a lot of stuff they have to work through, and there's this other theme of it with the Brendan Gleeson character, where there's this debt that's outstanding and there's, you know, just stuff they have to do to kind of reconcile that debt. But it's a great Irish cast. Like, you've got Donald Gleeson is in this as well, who I think is very, very good actor. You've got Jane Brennan.
See the point we were making a minute ago about Dublin.
Yeah.
I went down for a burger with my kid two weeks ago, and we were just sitting down there, and we both looked up at the same time. We both looked away at the same time because we were literally cheek by jowl with Donald Gleeson.
Yeah.
And we're just like, all right, yeah, there's another one. You know,
he's such a good actor. You've got in that film as well, you've got Brendan Coyle, who I think is very good as well. Generally does a lot of TV stuff, but he's excellent. You've got Liam Cunningham, who's a brilliant actor. Like, for me, he's one of the best performances in Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
I think he's outstanding in that. So it's a really strong cast, and it's a really good film. Now, again, it's not one that'll be hugely known, but it is genuinely excellent, and it's just one that I'd watch over and over again. And Jodie Whittaker, I should mention, is in it as well, who I'm a huge fan of. I was thrilled for her when she landed the role of Doctor Who. I thought it was a massive moment in TV history for her to become, you know, the first female Doctor. She's brilliant in Broadchurch. She's good in Time. She's one of the best, I think, one of the best actresses in the world. And I'm waiting to see her really get the big film role that I think she warrants. But she might not want it. She might prefer to stay working in the TV side of things, where maybe the scheduling works a little bit better for her, and she's got young kids and that, so she might prefer to be closer to home. But I think she's incredible, and she's really good in this film as well. So yeah, Perrier's Bounty is one I would highly recommend. If you can get your hands on it, and watch it. It's genuinely excellent.
That's 2009. And so I find myself at this stage having a look at the clock and seeing that we've gone into the hour. So I think we'll wrap this up in 70. And what I think we'll do then is we'll put on the long finger talking about the Chris Nolan aspect of things.
Yeah.
Except to do it in passing, because I don't know about you, but
Chris deserves his own
100%, man. That's just exactly what I was going to say. Let's do exactly that. Maybe let's do that as one of our two next week. We'll just flag it up now. Yeah. At least we know what we're doing then. But let's just take it. Like I say, it's increasingly big, big shows from now. And then we'll land on one or two things between now and the end of the 7 or 8 minutes we have left. So 2010 is a strange kind of a year for him. Tron Legacy is probably the biggest thing apart from Inception, which is obviously huge. We'll talk about it in detail when we do the Chris Nolan show, but it's a really big old role and a very front-facing performance for him in that. In 2011, there's an interesting movie called In Time that he plays in. He's in a movie called Retreat as well, which I'm not familiar with. In 2012, The Dark Knight Rises is the big one, where he's back as Jonathan Crane again. 2013's Quiet Enough. It's a short film, and a short film only. 2014, Transcendence is the one that I'd pick out from that year, which I thought was an interesting film. I only saw it recently. 2015, In the Heart of the Sea was a big one, which I didn't get to see yet. Then the following year, Anthropoid, very interesting film. And he again is an important role in that. But the one that I'm just going to pick, because obviously then between 2016 and now is where things get massive, between Peaky Blinders, Dunkirk, A Quiet Place Part 2, where he's got a lead, and Oppenheimer. But the one I'm going to land on, and then let you take it wherever you want to wrap the show up, is Free Fire in 2016. And the reason I'm going to land there is because I have been absolutely obsessed with the career of Ben Wheatley, who's the director here. He has got a back catalogue that I don't think misses a beat. There's Kill List, Sightseers, A Field in England, which to this day has the most frightening scene I've seen in a film ever.
Yeah.
And then High Rise, which is a really, it was thought to be an unfilmable book stroke script that kind of works. And then Free Fire. And I was so excited about Free Fire because the cast is mad. I didn't know what to expect from it. It's a really interesting cast. It's basically all these opposing factions in a small space shooting at each other. It's Brie Larson and Killian. Charlotte Copley's in it. Armie Hammer's in it. Jack Rayner, another Irishman's in it. Sam Riley's in it. Michael Smiley, fantastic Northern Irish actors in it. Noah Taylor. Lots of other faces you might recognize. So it's a very interesting film, but it's almost like a play with a lot of guns, if you know what I mean, because it's so contained. And I think that's probably what drew Wheatley to it, because his previous catalogue would not have you thinking he's going to be making a shoot 'em up action movie of any sort. And in a way it is, and in a way it isn't. But again, it's Killian holding the fort with another class performance. Just an absolute sort of reliable go-to bit of gravitas. He can sell you emotional, he can sell you emotionally stunted like Tommy Shelby, or he can sell you big, or he can sell you small. I just think he's fantastic, like genuinely. I think he's honestly getting better is the thing. The performance in Oppenheimer is very, very sort of tamped down in the way, in a different way than the Tommy Shelby one is. But he has the capacity to go big, to go small. He can just do it all. Where would you take it, just to finish us, in terms of a wrap up or a movie or two that you think we absolutely must mention before we finish?
Yeah, I mean, I've been, what's really impressed me with him is his work ethic, because he's, like you said, he's been making these big films now across the last number of years. Big films that are prolonged shoots, like Dunkirk took quite a long time for them to make happen. I'd imagine Oppenheimer was quite the slog to get made, because obviously, well, for a start, it's 3 hours long. But he's worked relentlessly in television as well. And obviously everybody knows Peaky Blinders, but while doing Peaky Blinders, he's also playing Julian Pearson's servant, and he's got a lead role in Good Omens as well. And he's done bits and pieces elsewhere. You know, he still has done theatre work over the years. He hasn't done anything in a few years now, but he has done theatre work. But I mean, we've kind of hit on all the ones I would have wanted to hit on. And I don't want to go too deep into Peaky Blinders either, because we've said that we might do sort of a season, an episode per season.
I think so.
Season thing. I think that'd be a great one to do.
Yeah.
And there's to be a film of that at some point as well. But one that it actually I've been obsessed with finding more about it. It was never released. Was Hippie Hippie Shake.
Yeah.
Which was to be released in 2010. But for whatever reason, in 2011, they announced it was never going to be released. And they did some test screenings and people, you know, had some contrasting views. But everybody came out and said, it's fun. Like, it's a really fun film. And it's based on the memoir of Richard Neville, no relation to Gary, who was the editor of the Australian satirical magazine Oz, and chronicles his relationship with his girlfriend. And it's about, you know, 1960s counterculture and the staff having to deal with a trial for distributing an obscene issue and stuff. And it's meant to be great fun. It's Cillian Murphy, it's Sienna Miller, Emma Booth is there, Hugh Bonneville, who's another tremendous actor. Chris O'Dowd is in it, another good Irish man. Like, it's a really good cast, and yet it's never been released for whatever, and the movie is finished, but has never been released for whatever reason. And I've been obsessed with somebody has to have a copy of it. Yeah. And I need that someone to share that copy on the internet so I can illegally download it and watch it, because it's been a long time. Because that film at that time, because Killian was riding such a high at that time, now obviously he's on the biggest high of his life now, but back then, he goes intermission, Batman Begins, Breakfast on Pluto, Wind That Shakes the Barley, Perrier's Bounty, which, as I've said, I loved. So it was literally whatever he's doing, I'm watching. Like, he was, you know, you just get those actors. Whatever they do, I'm going to watch. And this was to be his next one. And then it just disappeared and it never came out. And I'd love to know the story of why. And I've never heard anybody give a real explanation as to why it hasn't been released. So if anyone knows, let me know. I'd love to know. Killian, if you hear this, let me know. I need to know.
With the largely expanding gang of ears that are tuning into the show, for which we're mightily grateful and humbled by, I'm not going to be too shocked if there's not some dark web boys out there who might be able to ferry you exactly what you want there. I too am fascinated by things that I'm told I can't see, so yeah. I'd love a copy of it too. We will finish on that note at around the 70-minute mark. It feels as if, always with us, we could have got into detail on any one of those films or the ones that we just skipped by in a hurry. We'll do some due diligence in terms of trying to mention Killian in the collabs with Christopher Nolan, because we'll do Christopher Nolan and his movies next week as one of our shows. We have to come up with our top 10 for next week as well. But I think that's a good spot to wrap it. I've really enjoyed the conversation, and we are going to go and record our next one now immediately. So we won't do any elongated outros here, except to say that we've very much enjoyed bringing you another episode of Buzz. I've been Trev Downey. That was Dave Hendrick. We chatted theoretically about Killian Murphy and other things, and we'll be back with you for the second episode this week, which we're going to record right now, and it will be our top 10 favorite movie villains.
So favorite then, is the key word there.
Favorite is the key word. Don't come at us about how they're not the best ones. It's just the ones that we've liked the most. And we will forget them. Like, we left ones out of every top 10 we've done, much to our embarrassment. But we're only men. We're only innocent men. Good luck.
Sports Social Podcast Network.